It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2026. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today it was announced that the U.S. has sunk its first enemy ship, an Iranian ship off the coast of Sri Lanka, via torpedo for the first time since World War II. But as those munitions of yesteryear are a curiosity, the war-making technology of today playing the biggest part in this conflict are drones. Drones are cheap and effective, and even if most are intercepted or shot down, Iran has thousands of them. The Shahed is called a kamikaze drone, which I prefer to the phrase suicide drone when they're mostly used for homicide. They cost between $35,000 and $50,000, so for less than the price of a fully loaded Toyota Camry, Iran is capable and has been striking civilian targets like hotels in Dubai and also the occasional U.S. military asset. The United States, anticipating this, countered by grabbing some Shahed drones and turning them around against the Iranians. These drones are known as the Lucas drones, low-cost unmanned combat attack system. Cool, but the name, the Lucas, sounds like some kind of indie actor. Can't you do better, United States, which gave us Epic Fury and Midnight Hammer? Of course you can. This was Admiral Brad Cooper, head of CENTCOM.
Also for the first time, U.S. Central Command's drone task force called Task Force Scorpion Strike launched countless one-way attack drones, achieving massive effects. I'd like to point out these drones were originally an Iranian design. We took them back to America, made them better, and fired them right back at Iran.
Indeed, just as the drones of Joint Force Scorpion slam into an installation in Tehran, the last thing going through the mind of an IRCG colonel is, wait, isn't that our old friend the Shahed? Shahed, why are you turning on us? No, I'm just kidding. The last thing going through his mind was the ceiling. But in fact, the affordability of drones means that this isn't an easily defeated enemy. Proper interceptor missiles cost $3 million. A drone costs, like I said, less than the average Jeopardy winner is left with after he or she misses two daily doubles. War has become very cheap, and therefore it has a very low barrier to entry. Life remains not cheap, at least to the good guys of the world, who are against some bad guys with bad intentions and a budget to see those intentions through. On the show today, in the spiel, when the deeply unserious engage in the deeply serious undertaking of war. But first, an interview I'm very excited to bring to you. Brian Platzer is a real-life middle school teacher who's written a novel about a real-life middle school teacher using the real-life name of that teacher. The novel, as novels are, is a work of fiction, but it gets at truths, and In Truth is a wonderful, hilarious book that I immensely enjoyed. But then, in our conversation, Brian told me about his truly fascinating and horrible condition that has devastated his life, but not so devastated that he can't write a brilliant novel or three, and teach and parent and do interviews for us, but at a tremendous cost. So you must stick around and listen to this interview with Brian Platzer, who remains one of the optimists. The new novel by Brian Platzer, The Optimists, is part As I Lay Dying, part Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And, well, I don't want to give it all away, but what was that book with eco-terrorists? I think it was Vineland by Thomas Pynchon.
There you go.
Brian is on the show. He's also, just so you know, been a longtime listener of The Gist. So if you're a Brian Platzer completist and we start talking about things you don't understand, it's this podcast itself. Hello, Brian.
Such an honor to be here, Mike.
How many times, because I started underlining them on page 37 and 49, do you mention or use the word optimist, optimists, or optimistic?
I use it less than a dozen times, but more than a half dozen times. It becomes almost an obsession of the narrator to appear to be optimistic. I think part of what I'm playing with is there's a guy at the end of his life who's narrating the story of his life, and he's struggling. He had a stroke. He can't communicate. He has a lot to be upset about, and yet he wants his last statement to the world to be an optimistic statement. So the word comes up so often because I do think it's a work of optimism, but also that the narrator is consciously trying to exude optimism in an almost a thou doth protest too much type way.
Yeah, we don't find out that there's this conceit that the optimistic narrator is doing this via a contraption that takes into account the stroke he had until page, I don't know, 30 or 40. So tell me about the strategy there. When do you lay it on the reader who thinks he's just dealing with the reminiscence of a middle school teacher, that this middle school teacher has now become something Diving Bell and Butterfly-esque?
Well, Mr. Keating, the narrator, and actually the real man who was my 7th and 8th grade English teacher and the mentor of mine, he became a reverend to officiate my wedding. All of that is true in real life. He is, in his fictional incarnation, as anxious about his book appearing to be a slog as I was as the writer of this book. So I feared that if I put on page one, this book is narrated by a guy in a wheelchair using a contraption to narrate his thoughts, I would turn off everybody because that sounds depressing and slow. And I think that when I realized that Mr. Keating could share my anxieties as a writer, it made for a more exciting premise to me. So I wanted to delay it until I had the reader hooked, but I didn't want to hide it from the reader because I think it's an important part of the narrative technique.
Did you study the technology that would really be used for someone in that situation?
I did. And what was so confusing about the final decade of Mr. Keating's life in real life, as well as my attempt to articulate his voice after having had that stroke, is there's different technology for different types of brain disability. You know, I myself have a comparatively minor brain disability where I essentially...
Where you're a huge fan of the gist.
Exactly. That's where that's what it shows. That's the the greatest
the
indication.
The epiphenomenon.
Exactly. But essentially, I wake up really dizzy. I have to medicate profoundly, and then the medication starts to wear off around 2 p.m. So I've studied neurology beyond, you know, just as a area of interest. And what was so frustrating, feeling so close to the real man, Mr. Keating, was not knowing exactly what was transpiring in his brain. And there are different types of technology for different brain incapacitations, essentially. So my fictional move was to give him more ability to express himself than somebody with the ambiguity of his experience than that person could normally have. I sort of stumbled over that a little bit, but
you needed to, otherwise, I mean, you'd either create another complication, and you wanted to tell a story. You didn't want to tell a story that maximally got in the way of the story you were telling. You told the story as novels do, with a lot of questionable or a fair degree of the questionable narrator. I was going to say conceit, but it's sort of baked into the whole idea of the novel. So I understand why you had to do that. It would not only be a different novel, it would be a far different and frustrating experience. And then the experience of being frustrated would become what the novel was really about.
Not only the experience of being frustrated, but the experience of reading the book, where the Diving Bell and the Butterfly is real, you know, so it's nonfiction. But I think part of the pleasure of reading the Diving Bell and the Butterfly is that just as an artifact, it's so extraordinary, where because I'm in the world of novels, I need to tell a good story. So the artifact of pretending to write from the perspective of somebody who can't really tell his story, there's no victory there in the way that, you know, the Diving Bell and the Butterfly, just insofar as it exists, is a miracle.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Neil Young album Trans, which was essentially his least well-liked album. Is that a phrase? His poorest, the one that got the poorest reviews. But he still defends it as what it was, is he has an autistic son and he's trying to use the kind of electronic music that he knows is a little bit off-putting to get at his son's communication. But anyway, that's not the kind of work of art that you wanted to commit to.
No, I wanted an entertainment. I wanted something that would be
Now, you
fun.
Failed. I have to tell you, you failed horribly.
Is that true?
And this was a huge slog. No, you really didn't.
Well, it's rough of you to bring me on air to say that. You know, to invite me onto the show to publicly denounce the book. I thought that'd be below you, but bring it. I can take it.
This is the new segment of the show called Brickbat, where we bring along a aspiring or mid-level artist and just tell them the latest thing is shit.
I'm trying to work relatively my way up. Unknown mid-level literary writer and just to say, you know what, give it up. It just isn't working.
Someone who also supports my endeavors.
Exactly.
Too.
A big fan of yours whose work you dislike. Are there enough of us? Are there enough of sort of mediocre artists?
Though Brickbat hasn't aired, I've done 30 and now there are almost none left. Okay. No, it's a wonderful novel. It's so fun and it has time jumps and all of the characters are really fleshed out, and I especially like how you use character names, and you'll use a name that on the page, I'll say, wait, why is this character's name smashed together? And then 30 pages later, you'll understand that we as the reader had that question, and you'll explain it. So it was so well done in terms of that. You want to talk about your philosophy with character names, since Mr. Keating is kind of a bland name, though a real guy. Most of your main characters have main character energy names, but then all the side characters are kind of exquisitely, funnily named.
Well, you know, like Kingsley Richard Madison III, or like my deal with names is that they're all just
Enid Smeal.
Exactly. Enid Smeal was maybe my favorite. Names are just so silly as a novelist. Like you just make a thing up and then that becomes what you call the character. So I think the Dickensian route of just absurdity is a little bit too like, look at me, I'm creating names. And then just the general novelist route of like, this is Dave and this is Mike. I as a reader often forget which one's Dave and which one's Mike. So again, I'm trying to be as generous as I can to the reader. I thought you can remember Mr. Keating because he's the guy who's telling the story. You can remember Clara because she is the one who's whom the story is about, although I do give her a last name that ends up being similar to a characteristic verse later on. But for the rest of them, fuck it, right? Like, give characters names that are memorable, that you can separate from one another, and that maybe give you a giggle as you're reading.
How would you pronounce the name of that other teacher who Kingsley came on to before he was married?
Sylvia Gorog? Is that who you're referring to?
Oh, it's Sylvia.
There are multiple consonants before the name.
There's
but again,
an S and a Z. And
exactly.
A
but it's just, again, it's memorable on the page, which is what I was looking for.
And a palindromic last name.
Exactly.
Now, when I said it was entertaining, I do wonder, one of the aspects of the book that I love is that there are jokes. Not funny turns of phrase, not memorable, humorous scenes, but jokes. You commit to jokes, you tell jokes, you explain jokes. And I loved it. I don't think it's cheating at all. Was a small part of that. I know it advanced the plot in many ways, and Keating had tried stand-up comedy. But was part of that is you saying, look, if this doesn't work, at least I'll give the reader 45 pretty good jokes.
It was a little bit the opposite of that. That I, first off, as a middle school English teacher myself, I think the performative aspect of good teachers goes undiscussed. And I think that the difference between being a stand-up comedian and being a successful eighth grade English teacher is far smaller than one would initially imagine.
You have to deal with hecklers. There's not a 2-drink minimum, but there's lots of ADHD medication.
Exactly. There is medication, but there's not the
you got to do a
you're
tight
hoping,
set and get out when the light
you're
is on or
that
the
water
bell
bottle
rings.
Is full of water. But right. So there is my trying to just in every way I can demonstrate the performance aspect to the storytelling and to the way that Mr. Keating at the end of his life wants to be perceived. But I also think showing analysis is an important part of what I was trying to do. And other than maybe The Great Gatsby, which I can assume many of my readers have read, just giving people material and then having Mr. Keating analyze it was important to me. And then I thought, like, what would be the most enjoyable way to provide that material? And jokes did it for me. I just thought that that was a way to demonstrate him as a character and give the reader a little piece of pleasure before then that hopefully double pleasure of watching a professional analyzer analyze.
Yeah, by the way, what did The Great Gatsby call baseball? It's in your book.
Old sport. There we go. Old sport.
I was sure that's something that you mentioned when you taught your class Great Gatsby. Do you teach the eighth graders Great Gatsby?
No, it's in that middle range. When I teach high school, I'll teach high school kids. The eighth grade, finding books to teach eighth graders is probably a conversation for another time, but it needs, they're too old for YA literature. They're too young for sort of the masterpieces of American literature. So you're looking for books between 100 and 150 pages, including characters of their age, ideally, without too much sex, that they'll enjoy. And it leads to like five books. But again, for another day.
Was Catcher in the Rye still on the reading list?
So kids hate it. Whereas initially when Catcher in the Rye was taught, I think they thought it like, look at this guy bucking the system. You know, like he's one of us. And now they say, why is he complaining so much? Like his moodiness comes off as needy and immature as opposed to, you know, a fighting the system grumpiness. It's fascinating.
Yeah. I think maybe rebellion is so baked into everything that what made Holden unique makes him...
cringeworthy now. It's cringeworthy.
Yeah. And we've also, for the past 50 years, thought a lot more about mental health than it's not the people in Holden's time, but the people in J.D. Salinger's time. You know, so he was kind of inventing a character who wouldn't have been exposed to anyone caring about his inner workings, whereas that's unknown to children today.
Well, also, the brilliance of the book, you know, it being essentially a novel about mourning, it goes over the heads of most of the eighth graders anyway. Like, if read as a way to... you know, process the death of family members' death, I still think it holds up entirely. But again, that's not why it had been taught for generations to eighth graders.
So was the real Mr. Keating a teacher at that school or a teacher at a different school you went to?
He was. So he was my eighth grade English teacher, and he fundamentally changed my vision of reading, of writing, and of pedagogy in general. I mean, until being taught by Mr. Keating, teachers to me were folks to avoid in the hallways and to try to please by studying for tests. But he was a dedicated teacher for whom it was so clear that all of this mattered so much. And he was performative, and he would spend as many minutes, far more time, grading our work than it took for me to write it. So he encouraged me to keep on writing. I would send him in my work over the years. And then after grad school, when I came back to New York with no way to pay rent or healthcare, he said, you know, I can probably shoehorn you in for a class. I had been teaching at the college level, Johns Hopkins beforehand, and I kind of rolled my eyes at going and teaching eighth grade. It felt like something I had to do, and I just fell in love with it. And the real, you know, blessing of that decision was I got to hang out with Mr. Keating as his colleague for a couple of years. So I got to sit in the back of his classroom and see how, you know, we call it differentiation now, how we change the way we teach to different students based on who that student is. But that's the way he had taught forever, giving different assignments to different kids, letting students, you know, wait before answering a question versus pushing them into doing it. And being able to sit there and watch him at his sort of as a masterclass he gave me every day for a couple years until I asked him to become a reverend through the Universal Life Church to officiate my wedding. He was the officiant of my wedding to my wife. A week after, he had a massive stroke and was never able to speak or read or write or communicate again. So it went from him being this incredible dynamic, you know, one of the most important figures in my life to somebody I was visiting weekly and taking care of and reading to and having no idea what he was thinking or what was happening in his mind. So a lot of this book just started as notes with me trying to excise the demons of uncertainty, trying to figure out like how much of what I was telling him could he process and how much of the version of him that was still in my life could I try to articulate on his behalf. So long answer to the question, but yes, he was my teacher at the school where I currently teach. We taught together for a couple years. Then he had a stroke and I helped care for him for the last 10 years of his life.
So he lived for 10 years after that and no one had any idea about any of his thoughts from that moment on?
Correct. Couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't sign. None of the actual machines worked. And he, as I said, was a polyglot. He would read a novel a week in different languages. His whole life was performative. And then it became him sitting there as people read to him and spoke to him. And just the uncertainty mounted and mounted until I came home and I just wrote, like, what if he were thinking this? Or like, I wrote his side of the conversation until I stumbled into a plot and realized that maybe he could have more agency, or my version of him could have more agency, and he could be the brilliant, dynamic performer of my youth, just, you know, through the mechanism of my novel.
That's really nice. Did you tell him this, that you were doing this while he was with us?
No. What happened was I thought it would make him uncomfortable. I understand that.
That's what I was thinking. Downside. What if he objects, and then what do you do with that? And there's no way to register the objection. Yeah.
I don't think blessed is too strong a word, that at his funeral, I had both his stepson and his best friend come up to me independently and say, have you ever thought about, you know, writing about Rod Keating, like talking about him or something? And I said, oh, interesting. You know, let me think about that. You know, not telling them that I already had 100,000 words of his voice on my computer at home. And that those were the two closest people to him at his time. His wife was still around, but not in the position to, you know, make those choices for him yet. So being given that that homework assignment was incredibly thrilling at the end of his life.
What do they think of the book?
They haven't read it yet.
Okay, get back to us. That will be I've sent them
versions of it. I've told them what I was going to do, and they say we're just so thrilled that his voice will live on. I was with them taking care of him for a decade at the end. I think again, I realize this has become a theme of this, but I've earned their trust, I hope. And I really did everything I could to try to make the book engaging, entertaining, and honest to the real man.
So you mentioned you have a neurological, do we call it a disorder? I want to be accurate with this.
I think something happened
to you neurologically.
So yeah. I was always vulnerable, as far as I could tell, to losing some sort of neurological equilibrium. And then when I was 27, 28, I smoked pot and I was dizzy for a month. And it went away. And then in order to test me again a month later, I went through this test where they flood your ear canal with alternatingly very hot and very cold water. And I was dizzy for 2 years, bedridden, totally incapacitated, felt like I was 30 drinks in every time I woke up. I had to take a year off of teaching. All I did was try to go to different doctors around the world, around the country. Nobody could figure it out until finally a doctor who studies, you know, ambiguous neurological disorders sent me to the Mayo Clinic. A doctor stopped at the Mayo Clinic, says, we don't actually know what's going on, but if you take heavy doses of blood pressure medication, antidepressants, and anti-anxiety meds, we can probably buy you a few hours every morning. And that's what I've got. So I'm pretty clear from the hours of 8 to 1 or 2, at which point I lose vision and I experience pretty severe brain fog, etc.
Am I getting this right? It was the test that disabled you for 2 years?
Initially, it was the drugs, and then it was the test.
But the drugs only lasted, or the effect of that only lasted a short time.
Exactly. So it was a month of dizziness after the pot, and then after my ENT.
And that is the fade out, which means that PESCA Plus members get to hear more of the details of how Brian lives his life, some more about how he writes his books. And I know of no greater endorsement of the entire PESCA Plus enterprise, which can be subscribed to at subscribe.mikepesca.com, than the fact that Brian Platzer is a member, has been a member for years. And of course, I was going to interview him about this book. Even independent of that, it would be payola. But just to know you'd be in the company of such esteemed, and I'll say it, inspirational figures is maybe another inducement to get the podcast with extra content and ad-free and to support our show. Subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. It's easy to take the Trump administration's silly, bellicose rhetoric and turns of phrase more appropriate to Fox and Friends as evidence that they are unserious people. Even today, Secretary of Defense, War, Pete Hegseth, spoke to reporters as if he were reciting lines of dialogue from a Steven Seagal movie.
They are toast, and they know it. Or at least, soon enough, they will know it.
It's possible that because this is just how members of the administration talk and think, that there might be an actual pairing of this kind of childish sloganeering with actual see-it-through-to-the-end resolve. It's possible. I do tend to doubt it. When the Bush administration was accused of being cowboys, when George W. Bush said the following phrase,
I just remember, all I'm doing is remembering when I was a kid. I remember that they used to put out there in the Old West a wanted poster. It said, wanted, dead or alive.
If you recall, George Bush himself took a lot of heat for just that one utterance, and he later said it was a big regret, if not the biggest regret, of his administration. That phrase today would not even be in the top third of dismissive, cartoonish catchphrases used to describe a serious and deadly conflict. Bush always said,
we will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
And even though that is a slogan, it is a slogan that speaks to hard work and having goals that you're committed to. Donald Trump almost always speaks in the opposite way. He fancies himself a wheeler-dealer, and he likes to have escape clauses. He likes to preserve maximum wiggle room as a means of negotiation. He also doesn't have a deep, hard and fast commitment, or maybe even understanding of the truth. It's just not part of how he will ever think. So when it comes to this mission in Iran, I think that things are becoming very clear that resolve and clarity are not practices we can ever expect from Donald Trump or those closest to him. So whatever gee whiz, shock and awe, big bang that thrills Donald Trump at the beginning of the conflict, he will quickly lose patience for the next steps. To some extent, I guess you can argue that this is good. The MAGA base thinks this is good because a sincere commitment to that dreaded phrase, boots on the ground, is not what his party or, let's face it, this country wants. And while that could damn the Iranian regime, it could also very much bring down American interests with it. On the other hand, there are intermediate steps between this series of decapitation strikes and tens of thousands of U.S. forces in harm's way. But there's no evidence that Trump has considered, let alone committed, to those steps. When an unserious person, especially a venal self-serving person who always thinks of his instincts as correct, is given the power to make decisions, those decisions will almost always be glib and superficial. So the Ayatollah and his successor may have lost their lives. In fact, they have, and that is true. But what will really change in Iran? What evidence is there that anyone, not just Trump, but members in his much-loathed deep state, has put forward the hard work, the foresight, the diligence, persistence required to foment actual change in Iran? Trump understands saying, rise up, we encourage you to rise up. The Ayatollah's bad. The United States wants you to rise up. But with what? Rocks? Sticks? Intention? Has anyone ever thought out what a rising up might mean? Or who among those doing the rising might be armed or in some way able to avoid being put down by the still armed Iranian regime? There's no evidence that they have. I haven't written off the possibility that this war could lead to a better outcome than simply the death of an octogenarian who, by the way, didn't always seem to be guiding the country in the strategically optimal way. I'm talking about even judged by his own self-interest. There was some talk when the Ayatollah wasn't killed in June that that was by design because keeping the Ayatollah in place might have been steering Iran in the wrong direction. There's some talk of a lot of things. Now there's a lot of tough talk about toast. That's just who Donald Trump is and how Donald Trump always decides to assert himself. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Kathleen Sykes, she edits The Gist list. She puts it together. She slaps it up there at mikepesca.substack.com. Jeff Craig edits so much of the show. You know, he's the editor of How To. All those words are chopped together by him. He does our videos as well. Ben Astaire is our booking coordinator. And Michelle Pesca oversees it all. Umpuru, Jipuru, Dupuru. And thanks for listening.